Tide 5, Ubik by Philip K. Dick, continuing on page 178. Metabolism, he reflected, is a burning process, an active furnace. When it ceases to function, life is over. They must be wrong about hell, he said to himself. Hell is cold. Everything there is cold. The body means weight and heat. Now, weight is a force which I am succumbing to, and heat, my heat, is slipping away. And unless I become reborn, it will never return. This is the destiny of the universe. So, at least, I won't be alone. But he felt alone. It's overtaking me too soon, he realized. The proper time hasn't come. Something has hurried this up. Some conniving thing has accelerated it, out of malice and curiosity. A polymorphic, perverse agency which likes to watch. An infantile, retarded entity which enjoys what's happening. It has crushed me like a bent-legged insect, he said to himself. A simple bug which does nothing but hug the earth, which can never fly or escape, can only descend step by step into what is deranged and foul, into the world of the tomb which a perverse entity, surrounded by its own filth, inhabits, the thing we call Pat. Do you have your key, Pat asked, to your room? Think how awful you'll feel to get up to the second floor and find you had lost your key and couldn't get into your room. I have it. He groped in his pockets. His coat ripped away, tattered and in shreds. It fell from him, and from its top pocket the key slid. It fell two steps down, below him, beyond reach. Pat said briskly, I'll get it for you. Darting by him, she scooped up the key, held it to the light to examine it, then laid it at the top of the flight of stairs on the railing. Right up here, she said, where you can reach it when you, through climbing, your reward. The room, I think, is to the left, about four doors down the hall. You'll have to move slowly, but it'll be a lot easier once you're off the stairs, once you don't have to climb. I can see, he said, the key and the top. I can see the top of the stairs. With both arms grasping the banister, he dragged himself upward, ascended three steps in one agonizing expenditure of himself. He felt it deplete him. The weight on him grew, the cold grew, and the substantiality of himself waned. But he had reached the top. Goodbye, Joe, Pat said. She hovered over him, kneeling slightly, so that he could see her face. You don't want Don Denny bursting in, do you? A doctor won't be able to help you, so I'll tell him that I got the hotel people to call a cab and that you're on your way across town to a hospital. That way you won't be bothered. You can be entirely by yourself. Do you agree? Yes, he said. Here's the key. She pushed the cold metal thing into his hand, closed his fingers about it. Keep your chin up, as they say here in 39. Don't take any wooden nickels. They say that, too. She slipped away then, onto her feet. For an instant she stood there scrutinizing him, and then she darted off down the hall to the elevator. He saw her press the button. Wait. He saw the door slide open, and then Pat disappeared. Gripping the key, he rose lurchingly to a crouched position. He balanced himself against the far wall of the corridor, then turned to the left and began to walk step by step, still supporting himself by means of the wall. Darkness, he thought. It isn't lit. He squeezed his eyes shut, opened them, blinked. Sweat from his face still blinded him, still stung. He could not tell if the corridor were genuinely dark or whether his power of sight was fading out. By the time he reached the first door, he had been reduced to crawling. He tilted his head up, sought for the number on the door. No, not this one. He crept on. When he found the proper door, he had to stand erect, propped up, to insert the key in the lock. The effort finished him. The key still in his hand, he fell. His head struck the door, and he flopped back onto the dust-choked carpet, smelling the odor of age and wear and frigid death. I can't get in the room, he realized. I can't stand up anymore. But he had to. Out here he could be seen. Gripping the knob with both hands, he tugged himself onto his feet one more time. He rested his weight entirely against the door as he tremblingly poked the key in the direction of the knob and the lock. This way, once he had turned the key, the door would fall open and he would be inside. And then, he thought, if I can close the door after me, and if I can get to the bed, it'll be over. The lock grated. The metal unit hauled itself back. The door opened and he pitched forward, arms extended. The floor rose toward him and he made out shapes in the carpet, swirls and designs and floral entities in red and gold, but worn into roughness and lusterlessness. The colors had dimmed, and as he struck the floor, feeling little, if any, pain, he thought, this is very old, this room. When this place was first built, they probably did use an open iron cage for an elevator. So I saw the actual elevator, he said to himself. The authentic, original one. He lay for a time and then, as if called, summoned into motion, stirred. He lifted himself up onto his knees, placed his hands flat before him. My hands, he thought. Good God! Parchment hands. Yellow and knobby, like the ass of a cooked dry turkey. Bristly skin, not like human skin. Pin feathers, as if I've devolved back millions of years to something that flies and coasts, using its skin as a sail. Opening his eyes, he searched for the bed. He strove to identify it. The fat, far window, admitting gray light through its web of curtains, a vanity table, ugly, with lank legs, then the bed, with brass knobs capping its rail sides, bent and irregular as if years of use had twisted the railings, warped the varnished wooden headboards. I want to get on it, even so, he said to himself. He reached toward it, slid and dragged himself farther into the room, and saw then a figure seated in an overstuffed chair, facing him. A spectator who had made no sound, but who now stood up and came rapidly toward him. Glenn Runciter. I couldn't help you climb the stairs, Runciter said, his heavy face stern. She would have seen me. Matter of fact, I was afraid she'd come all the way into the room with you. And then we'd be in trouble because she... He broke off, bent and hoisted Joe up to his feet as if Joe had no weight left in him, no remaining material constituents. We'll talk about that later. Here. He carried Joe under his arm across the room, not to the bed, but to the overstuffed chair in which he himself had been sitting. Can you hold on a few seconds longer, Runciter asked. I want to shut and lock the door, in case she changes her mind. Yes, Joe said. Runciter strode in three big steps to the door, slammed it and bolted it, came at once back to Joe. Opening a drawer of the vanity table, he hastily brought out a spray can with bright stripes, balloons and lettering glorifying its shiny surfaces. Uvik, Runciter said. He shook the can mightily, then stood before Joe, aiming it at him. Don't thank me for this, he said, and sprayed prolongedly left and right. The air flickered and shimmered, as if bright particles of light had been released, as if the sun's energy sparkled here in this worn-out elderly hotel room. Feel better? It should work on you right away. You should already be getting a reaction. He eyed Joe with anxiety. Chapter 14. It takes more than a bag to seal in food flavor. It takes Uvik plastic wrap. Actually, four layers in one. Keeps freshness in, air and moisture out. Watch this simulated test. Do you have a cigarette? Joe said. His voice shook, but not from weariness, nor from cold. Both had gone. I'm tense, he said to himself, but I'm not dying. That process has been stopped by the Uvik spray. As Runciter said it would, he remembered, in his taped TV commercial. If I could find it, I would be all right. Runciter promised that, but, he thought somberly, it took a long time, and I almost didn't get to it. No filter tips, Runciter said. They don't have filtration devices on their cigarettes in this backward, no-good time period. He held a pack of Camels toward Joe. I'll light it for you. He struck a match and extended it. It's fresh, Joe said. Oh, hell yes. Christ, I just now bought it downstairs at the tobacco counter. We're a long way into this, well past the stage of clotted milk and stale cigarettes. He grinned starkly, his eyes determined and bleak, reflecting no light. In it, he said, not out of it. There's a difference. He lit a cigarette for himself, too. Leaning back, he smoked in silence, his expression still grim, and, Joe decided, tired, but not the kind of tiredness that he himself had undergone. Joe said, can you help the rest of the group? I had exactly one can of this Ubik. Most of it I had to use on you. He gestured with resentment, his fingers convulsed in a tremor of unresigned anger. My ability to alter things here is limited. I've done what I could. His head jerked as he raised his eyes to glare at Joe. I got through to you, all of you, every chance I could, every way I could. I did everything that I had the capacity to bring about. Damn little, almost nothing. He lapsed then into smoldering, brooding silence. The graffiti on the bathroom wall, Joe said. You wrote that. We were dead, and you were alive. I am alive, Runciter rasped. Are we dead, the rest of us? After a long pause, Runciter said, yes. But in the taped TV commercial, that was for the purpose of getting you to fight, to find Ubik. It made you look, and you kept on looking, too. I kept trying to get it to you, but you know what went wrong. She kept drawing everyone into the past. She worked on us all with that talent of hers. Over and over again, she regressed it and made it worthless, Runciter added. Except for the fragmentary notes I managed to slip to you in conjunction with the stuff. Urgently, he pointed his heavy, determined finger at Joe, gesturing with vigor. Look what I've been up against. The same thing that got all of you, that's killed you off one by one. Frankly, it's amazing to me that I was able to do as much as I could. Joe said, when did you figure out what was taking place? Did you always know from the start? The start, Runciter echoed bitingly. What's that mean? It started months, or maybe even years ago. God knows how long Hollis and Nick and Pat Conley and S. Dole Melipone and G.G. Ashwood have been hatching it up, working it over and reworking it like dough. Here's what happened. We got lured to Luna. We let Pat Conley come with us, a woman we didn't know, a talent we didn't understand, which possibly even Hollis doesn't understand. An ability, anyhow, connected with time reversion. Not strictly speaking, the ability to travel through time. For instance, she can't go into the future. In a certain sense, she can't go into the past either. What she does, as near as I can comprehend it, is start a counter-process that uncovers the prior stages inherent in configurations of matter. But you know that. You and Al figured it out. He ground his teeth with wrath. Al Hammond, what a loss. But I couldn't do anything. I couldn't break through then as I've done now. Why were you able to now? Joe asked. Runciter said, because this is as far back as she is able to carry us. Normal forward flow has already resumed. We're again flowing from past into present into future. She evidently stretched her ability to its limit. 1939, that's the limit. What she's done now is shut off her talent. Why not? She's accomplished what Ray Hollis sent her to us to do. How many people have been affected? Just the group of us who were on Luna there in that subsurface room? Not even Zoe Wirt. Pat can circumscribe the range of the field she creates. As far as the rest of the world is concerned, the bunch of us took off for Luna and got blown up in an accidental explosion. We were put into cold pack by Solicitor Stanton Mick, but no contact could be established. They didn't get us soon enough. Joe said, why wouldn't the bomb blast be enough? Lifting an eyebrow, Runciter regarded him. Why use Pat Conley at all? Joe said. He sensed, even in his weary, shaken state, something wrong. There's no reason for all this reversion machinery, this sinking us into a retrograde time momentum back here to 1939. It serves no purpose. That's an interesting point, Runciter said. He nodded slowly, a frown on his rugged, stony face. I'll have to think about it. Give me a little while. He walked to the window, stood gazing out at the stores across the street. "It strikes me," Joe said, "that what we appear to be faced with is a malignant rather than a purposeful force. Not so much someone trying to kill us or nullify us, someone trying to eliminate us from functioning as a prudence organization, but," he pondered, he almost had it, "an irresponsible entity that's enjoying what it's doing to us, the way it's killing us off one by one. It doesn't have to prolong all this. That doesn't sound to me like Ray Hollis. He deals in cold, practical murder. And from what I know about Stanton Mick, Pat herself," Runciter interrupted brusquely. He turned away from the window. "She's psychologically a sadistic person, like tearing wings off flies, playing with us." He watched for Joe's reaction. Joe said, "It sounds to me more like a child. But look at Pat Conley. She's spiteful and jealous. She got Wendy first because of emotional animosity. She followed you all the way up the stairs just now, enjoying it, gloating over it, in fact." "How do you know that?" Joe said. "You were waiting here in this room," he said to himself. "You couldn't have seen it. And how had Runciter known he would come to this particular room?" Letting out his breath in a ragged, noisy rush, Runciter said, "I haven't told you all of it. As a matter of fact," he ceased speaking, chewed his lower lip savagely, then abruptly resumed, "what I've said hasn't been strictly true. I don't hold the same relationship to this regressed world that the rest of you do. You're absolutely right. I know too much. It's because I enter it from outside, Joe." "Manifestations," Joe said. "Yes. Thrust down into this world here and there, at strategic points and times, like the traffic citation, like Arches..." "You didn't tape that TV commercial," Joe said. "That was live," Runciter, with reluctance, nodded. "Why the difference," Joe said, "between your situation and ours?" "You want me to say?" "Yes." He prepared himself, already knowing what he would hear. "I'm not dead, Joe. The graffiti told the truth. You're all in cold pack, and I'm..." Runciter spoke with difficulty, not looking directly at Joe. "I'm sitting in a consultation lounge at the beloved Brethren Moratorium. All of you are interwired on my instructions, kept together as a group. I'm out here trying to reach you. That's where I am when I say I'm outside. That's why the manifestations, as you call them... For 1 week now, I've been trying to get you all functioning in half-life, but it isn't working. You're fading out, one by one." After a pause, Joe said, "What about Pat Conley?" "Yeah, she's with you, in half-life, interwired to the rest of the group." "Are the regressions due to her talent, or to the normal decay of half-life?" Tensely, he waited for Runciter's answer. Everything as he saw it hung on this one question. Runciter snorted, grimaced, then said hoarsely, "The normal decay. Ella experienced it. Everyone who enters half-life experiences it." "You're lying to me," Joe said, and felt a knife shear through him. Staring at him, Runciter said, "Joe, my God, I saved your life. I broke through to you enough just now to bring you back into full half-life functioning. You'll probably go on indefinitely now. If I hadn't been waiting here in this hotel room when you came crawling through that door, why, hell... Hey, look, goddammit, you'd be lying on that rundown bed, dead as a doornail by now, if it wasn't for me. I'm Glenn Runciter, I'm your boss, and I'm the one fighting to save all your lives. I'm the only one out here in the real world plugging for you." He continued to stare at Joe with heated indignation and surprise, a bewildered, injured surprise, as if he could not fathom what was happening. "That girl," Runciter said, "that Pat Conley, she would have killed you like she killed..." He broke off. Joe said, "Like she killed Wendy and Al, Edie Dorn, Fred Zafsky, and maybe by now Tito Apostas." In a low but controlled voice, Runciter said, "This situation is very complex, Joe. It doesn't admit to simple answers." "You don't know the answers," Joe said. "That's the problem. You made up answers. You had to invent them to explain your presence here. All your presences here, your so-called manifestations. I don't call them that. You and Al worked out that name. Don't blame me for what you two... You don't know any more than I do, Joe said, about what's happening to us and who's attacking us. Glenn, you can't say who we're up against because you don't know, Runciter said. I know I'm alive. I know I'm sitting out here in this consultation lounge at the moratorium. Your body in the coffin, Joe said. Here at the Simple Shepherd Mortuary. Did you look at it? No, Runciter said, but that isn't really. It had withered, Joe said. Lost bulk, like Wendy's and Al's and Edie's, and in a little while, mine. Exactly the same for you. No better, no worse. In your case, I got Ubik again, Runciter broke off. A difficult to decipher expression appeared on his face. A combination, perhaps, of insight, fear, and... But Joe couldn't tell. I got you the Ubik, he finished. What is Ubik? Joe said. There was no answer from Runciter. You don't know that either, Joe said. You don't know what it is or why it works. You don't even know where it comes from. After a long, agonized pause, Runciter said, You're right, Joe. Absolutely right. Tremulously, he lit another cigarette. But I wanted to save your life. That part's true. Hell, I'd like to save all your lives. The cigarette slipped from his fingers. It dropped to the floor, rolled away. With labored effort, Runciter bent over to grope for it. On his face showed extreme and clear-cut unhappiness, almost a despair. We're in this, Joe said, and you're sitting out there, out in the lounge, and you can't do it. You can't put a stop to the thing we're involved in. That's right, Runciter nodded. This is cold pack, Joe said, but there's something more. Something not natural to people in half-life. There are two forces at work, as Al figured out. One helping us, and one destroying us. You're working with the force or entity or person that's trying to help us. You got the Ubik from them. Yes, Joe said. So none of us know, even yet, who it is that's destroying us, and who it is that's protecting us. You outside don't know, and we in here don't know. Maybe it's Pat. I think it is, Runciter said. I think there's your enemy, Joe said. Almost, but I don't think so. I don't think, he said to himself, that we've met our enemy face to face, or our friend either, he thought. But I think we will. Before long we will know who they both are. Are you sure, he asked Runciter, absolutely sure, that you're beyond doubt the only one who survived the blast? Think before you answer. Like I said, Zoe Wirt, of us, Joe said. She's not here in this time segment with us. Pat Conley, for example. Pat Conley's chest was crushed. She died of shock and a collapsed lung with multiple internal injuries, including a damaged liver and a leg, broken in three places. Physically speaking, she's about 4 feet away from you, her body, I mean. And it's the same for all the rest. They're all here in Cold Pack at the beloved Brethren Moratorium, Runciter said, with one exception, Sammy Mundo. He suffered massive brain damage and lapsed into a coma, out of which they say he'll never emerge. The cortical... Then he's alive. He's not in Cold Pack. He's not here. I wouldn't call it alive. They've run encephalograms on him. No cortical activity at all. A vegetable, nothing more. No personality, no motion, no consciousness. There's nothing happening in Mundo's brain. Nothing in the slightest, Joe said. So, therefore, you naturally didn't think to mention it. I mentioned it now. When I asked you, he reflected, how far is he from us? In Zurich? We sat down here in Zurich, yes. He's at the Carl Jung Hospital, about a quarter mile from this moratorium. Rent a telepath, Joe said, or use G.G. Ashwood. Have him scanned. A boy, he said to himself, disorganized and immature, a cruel, unformed, peculiar personality. This may be it, he said to himself. It would fit in with what we're experiencing, the capricious, contradictory happenings, the pulling off of our wings and then the putting back, the temporary restorations, as in just now with me here in this hotel room after my climb up the stairs. Runciter sighed. We did that. In brain injury cases like this, it's a regular practice to try to reach the person telepathically. No results, nothing. No frontal lobe cerebration of any sort. Sorry, Joe. He wagged his massive head in a sympathetic, tick-like motion. Obviously, he shared Joe's disappointment. Removing the plastic disc from its place, its firm adhesion to his ear, Glenn Runciter said into the microphone, I'll talk to you again later. He now set down all the communications apparatus, rose stiffly from the chair, and momentarily stood facing the misty, immobile, ice-bound shape of Joe Chip, resting within its transparent plastic casket, upright and silent, as it would be for the rest of eternity. Did you ring for me, sir? Herbert Schoenheit von Vogelsong scuttled into the consultation lounge, cringing like a medieval toady. Shall I put Mr. Chip back with the others? You're done, sir, Runciter said. I'm done. Did you? Yes, I got through all right. We could hear each other fine this time. He lit a cigarette. It had been hours since he had had one. Had found a free moment. By now, the arduous, prolonged task of reaching Joe Chip had depleted him. Do you have an amphetamine dispenser nearby? He asked the moratorium owner. In the hall outside the consultation lounge. The eager-to-please creature pointed. Leaving the lounge, Runciter made his way to the amphetamine dispenser. He inserted a coin, pushed the choice lever, and into the drop slot a small familiar object slid with a tinkling sound. The pill made him feel better, but then he thought about his appointment with Len Niggleman 2 hours from now and wondered if he could really make it. There's been too much going on, he decided. I'm not ready to make my formal report to the society. I'll have to vid Niggleman and ask for a postponement. Using a payphone, he called Niggleman back in the North American Confederation. Len, he said, I can't do any more today. I've spent the last 12 hours trying to get through to my people in Coldback, and I'm exhausted. Would tomorrow be okay? Niggleman said, the sooner you file your official formal statement with us, the sooner we can begin action against Hollis. My legal department says it's open and shut. They're chapping at the bit. They think they can make a civil charge stick. Civil and criminal. They've been talking to the New York District Attorney. But until you make a formal notarized report to us tomorrow, Runciter promised, after I get some sleep, this has damn near finished me off. This loss of all my best people, he said to himself, especially Joe Chip. My organization is depleted, and we won't be able to resume commercial operations for months, maybe years. God, he thought, where am I going to get in nurses to replace those I've lost? And where am I going to find a tester like Joe? Niggleman said, sure, Glenn. Get a good night's sleep, and then meet me in my office tomorrow, say, at 10 o'clock our time. Thanks, Runciter said. He rang off, then threw himself heavily down on a pink plastic couch across the corridor from the phone. I can't find a tester like Joe, he said to himself. The fact of the matter is that Runciter Associates is finished. The moratorium owner came in, then, putting in another of his untimely appearances. Can I get you anything, Mr. Runciter? A cup of coffee? Another amphetamine? Perhaps a 12-hour spansule? In my office I have some 24-hour spansules. One of those would get you back up into action for hours, if not all night. All night, Runciter said, I intend to sleep. Then how about a flap away, Runciter grated. The moratorium owner scuttled off, leaving him alone. Why did I have to pick this place, Runciter asked himself. I guess because Ella's here, it is, after all, the best. That's why she's here, and hence why they're all here. Think of them, he reflected. So many who were so recently on this side of the casket. What a catastrophe. Ella, he said to himself, remembering, I'd better talk to her again for a moment, to let her know how things are going. That's, after all, what I told her I'd do. Getting to his feet, he started off in search of the moratorium owner. "Am I going to get that damn jury this time?" he asked himself. "Or will I be able to keep Ella in focus long enough to tell her what Joe said? It's become so hard to hang on to her now, with Jory growing and expanding and feeding on her and maybe on others over there in Half-Life. The moratorium should do something about him. Jory's a hazard to everyone here. Why do they let him go on?" he asked himself. He thought, maybe because they can't stop him. Maybe there's never been anyone in Half-Life like Jory before. Chapter 15. Could it be that I have bad breath, Tom? Well, Ed, if you're worried about that, try today's new Ubik with powerful germicidal foaming action, guaranteed safe when taken as directed. The door of the ancient hotel room swung open. Don Denny, accompanied by a middle-aged, responsible-looking man with neatly trimmed gray hair, entered. Denny, his face strained with apprehension, said, "How are you, Joe? Why aren't you lying down? For Christ's sake, get onto the bed." "Please lie down, Mr. Chip," the doctor said as he set his medical bag on a vanity table and opened it up. "Is there pain along with the enervation and the difficult respiration?" He approached the bed with an old-fashioned stethoscope and cumbersome blood pressure reading equipment. "Do you have any history of cardiac involvement, Mr. Chip? Or your mother or father? Unbutton your shirt, please." He drew up a wooden chair beside the bed, seated himself expectantly on it. Joe said, "I'm okay now." "Let him listen to your heart," Denny said tersely. "Okay." Joe stretched out on the bed and unbuttoned his shirt. "Runciter managed to get through to me," he said to Denny. "We're in cold pack. He's on the other side trying to reach us. Someone else is trying to injure us. Pat didn't do it, or anyhow, she didn't do it alone. Neither she nor Runciter knows what's going on. When you opened the door, did you see Runciter?" "No," Denny said. "He was sitting across the room from me," Joe said, 2-3 minutes ago." "Sorry, Joe," he said. "That was the last thing he said to me, and then he cut contact. Stopped communicating, just canceled himself out. Look on the vanity table and see if he left the spray can of Ubik." Denny searched, then held up the brightly illuminated can. "Here it is, but it seems empty." Denny shook it. "Almost empty," Joe said. "Spray what's left on yourself. Go ahead." He gestured emphatically. "Don't talk, Mr. Chip," the doctor said, listening to his stethoscope. He then rolled up Joe's sleeve and began winding inflatable rubber fabric around his arm in preparation for the blood pressure test. "How's my heart?" Joe asked. "Appears normal," the doctor said, "although slightly fast." "See," Joe said to Don Denny, "I've recovered." Denny said, "The others are dying, Joe." Half sitting up, Joe said, "All of them?" "Everyone that's left." He held the can, but did not use it. "Pat, too?" Joe asked. "When I got out of the elevator on the second floor here, I found her. It had just begun to hit her. She seemed terribly surprised. Apparently she couldn't believe it." He set the can down again. "I guess she thought she was doing it with her talent," Joe said. "That's right, that's what she thought. Why won't you use the Ubik?" "Hell, Joe, we're going to die. You know it, and I know it." He removed his horn-rimmed glasses and rubbed his eyes. "After I saw Pat's condition, I went into the other rooms, and that's when I saw the rest of them, of us. That's why we took so long getting here. I had Dr. Taylor examine them. I couldn't believe they'd dwindled away so fast. The acceleration has been so goddamn great in just the last hour. Use the Ubik," Joe said, "or I'll use it on you." Don Denny again picked up the can, again shook it, pointed the nozzle toward himself. "All right," he said, "if that's what you want. There really isn't any reason not to. This is the end, isn't it? I mean, they're all dead. Only you and I are left, and the Ubik is going to wear off you in a few hours, and you won't be able to get any more, which will leave me." His decision made, Denny depressed the button of the spray can. The shimmering, palpitating vapor, filled with particles of metallic light that danced nimbly, formed at once around him. Don Denny disappeared, concealed by the nimbus of radiant, ergic excitement. Pausing in his task of reading Joe's blood pressure, Dr. Taylor twisted his head to see. Both he and Joe watched as the vapor now condensed. Puddles of it glistened on the carpet, and down the wall behind Denny it drizzled in bright streaks. The cloud concealing Denny evaporated. The person standing there in the center of the vaporizing stain of ubiquity that had saturated the worn and dingy carpet was not Don Denny. An adolescent boy, mawkishly slender, with irregular black button eyes beneath tangled brows, he wore an anachronistic costume, white drip-dry shirt, jeans, and laceless leather slippers, clothes from the middle of the century. On his elongated face, Joe saw a smile, but it was a misshapen smile, a thwarted crease that became now almost a jeering leer. No two features matched. His ears had too many convolutions in them to fit with his chitinous eyes. His straight hair contradicted the interwoven curly bristles of his brows. And his nose, Joe thought, too thin, too sharp, far too long. Even his chin failed to harmonize with the balance of his face. It had a deep chisel mark in it, a cleft obviously penetrating far up into the bone, Joe thought, as if at that point the manufacturer of this creature struck it a blow aimed at obliterating it. But the physical material, the base substance, had been too dense. The boy had not fractured and split apart. He existed in defiance of even the force that had constructed him. He jeered at everything else, and it too. "Who are you?" Joe said. The boy's fingers writhed, a twitch protecting him, evidently, from a stammer. "Sometimes I call myself Matt, and sometimes Bill," he said, "but mostly I'm Jory. That's my real name, Jory." Gray, shabby teeth showed as he spoke, and a grubby tongue. After an interval, Joe said, "Where's Denny? He never came into this room, did he?" "Dead," he thought, "with the others." "I ate Denny a long time ago," the boy Jory said, "right at the beginning, before they came here from New York. First I ate Wendy Wright. Denny came second," Joe said. "How do you mean, ate? Literally?" he wondered, his flesh undulating with aversion. The gross physical motion rolled through him, engulfing him, as if his body wanted to shrink away. However, he managed more or less to conceal it. "I did what I do," Jory said. "It's hard to explain, but I've been doing it a long time to lots of half-life people. I eat their life, what remains of it. There's very little in each person, so I need a lot of them. I used to wait until they had been in half-life a while, but now I have to have them immediately. If I'm going to be able to live myself, if you come close to me and listen, I'll hold my mouth open. You can hear their voices. Not all of them, but anyhow, the last ones I ate, the ones you know." With his fingernail, he picked at an upper incisor, his head tilted on one side as he regarded Joe, evidently waiting to hear his reaction. "Don't you have anything to say?" he said. "It was you who started me dying down there in the lobby. Me and not Pat. I ate her out in the hall by the elevator, and then I ate the others. I thought you were dead." He rotated the can of ubiquity, which he still held. "I can't figure this out. What's in it, and where does Runciter get it?" he scowled. "But Runciter can't be doing it. You're right. He's on the outside. This originates from within our environment. It has to, because nothing can come in from outside except words," Joe said. "So there's nothing you can do to me. You can't eat me because of the ubik." "I can't eat you for a while, but the ubik will wear off." "You don't know that. You don't even know what it is or where it comes from." "I wonder if I can kill you," he thought. The boy Jory seemed delicate. "This is the thing that got Wendy," he said to himself. "I'm seeing it face to face, as I knew I eventually would. Wendy, Al, the real Don Denny, all the rest of them. It even ate Runciter's corpse as it lay in a casket at the mortuary. There must have been a flicker of residual protophasic activity in or near it, or something anyhow, which attracted him." The doctor said, "Mr. Chip, I didn't have a chance to finish taking your blood pressure. Please lie back down." Joe stared at him, then said, "Didn't he see you change, Jory? Hasn't he heard what you've been saying?" "Dr. Taylor is a product of my mind," Jory said, "like every other fixture in this pseudo-world." "I don't believe it," Joe said. To the doctor, he said, "You heard what he's been saying, didn't you?" With a hollow, whistling pup. The doctor disappeared. See? Jory said, pleased. What are you going to do when I'm killed off? Joe asked the boy. Will you keep on maintaining this 1939 world, this pseudo-world, as you call it? Of course not. There'd be no reason to. Then it's all for me, just for me, this entire world? Jory said. It's not very large. One hotel in Des Moines, and a street outside the window with a few people and cars, and maybe a couple of other buildings thrown in, stores across the street for you to look at when you happen to see out. So you're not maintaining any New York or Zurich, or why should I? No one's there. Wherever you and the others of the group went, I constructed a tangible reality corresponding to their minimal expectations. When you flew here from New York, I created hundreds of miles of countryside, town after town. I found that very exhausting. I had to eat a great deal to make up for that. In fact, that's the reason I had to finish off the others so soon after you got here. I needed to replenish myself, Joe said. Why 1939? Why not our own contemporary world, 1992? The effort. I can't keep objects from regressing. Doing it all alone, it was too much for me. I created 1992 at first, but then things began to break down. The coins, the cream, the cigarettes, all those phenomena that you noticed. And then Runciter kept breaking through from outside. That made it even harder for me. Actually, it would have been better if he hadn't interfered. Jory grinned slyly. But I didn't worry about the reversion. I knew you'd figure it was Pat Conley. It would seem like her talent, because it's sort of like what her talent does. I thought maybe the rest of you would kill her. I would enjoy that. His grin increased. What's the point of keeping this hotel and the street outside going for me now, Joe said, now that I know? But I always do it this way, Jory's eyes widened. Joe said, I'm going to kill you. He stepped toward Jory in an uncoordinated half-falling motion. Raising his open hands, he plunged against the boy, trying to capture the neck, searching for the bent pipe stem windpipe with all his fingers. Snarling, Jory bit him. The great shovel teeth fastened deep into Joe's right hand. They hung on as, meanwhile, Jory raised his head, lifting Joe's hand with his jaw. Jory stared at him with unwinking eyes, snoring wetly as he tried to close his jaws. The teeth sank deeper, and Joe felt the pain of it throughout him. He's eating me, he realized. You can't, he said aloud. He hit Jory on the snout, punching again and again. The Ubi keeps you away, he said as he cuffed Jory's jeering eyes. You can't do it to me. Gum growl, Jory bubbled, working his jaws sideways like a sheep's, grinding Joe's hand until the pain became too much for Joe to stand. He kicked Jory. The teeth released his hand. He crept backward, looking at the blood rising from the punctures made by the troll teeth. Jesus, he said to himself, appalled. You can't do to me, Joe said, what you did to them. Locating the spray can of Ubik, he pointed the nozzle toward the bleeding wound which his hand had become. He pressed the red plastic stud, and a weak stream of particles emerged and settled in a film over the chewed, torn flesh. The pain immediately departed. Before his eyes, the wound healed. And you can't kill me, Jory said. He still grinned, Joe said. I'm going downstairs. He walked unsteadily to the door of the room and opened it. Outside lay the dingy hall. He started forward, step by step, treading carefully. The floor, however, seemed substantial, not a quasi or irreal world at all. Don't go too far, Jory said from behind him. I can't keep too great an area going. Like, if you were to get into one of those cars and drive for miles, eventually you'd reach a point where it breaks down, and you wouldn't like that any better than I do. I don't see what I have to lose. Joe reached the elevator, pressed the down button. Jory called after him. I have trouble with elevators. They're complicated. Maybe you should take the stairs. After waiting a little longer, Joe gave up. As Jory had advised, he descended by the stairs, the same flight up which he had so recently come, step by step, in an agony of effort. Well, he thought, that's one of the two agencies who are at work. Jory is the one who's destroying us, has destroyed us, except for me. Behind Jory, there is nothing. He is the end. Will I meet the other? Probably not soon enough for it to matter, he decided. He looked once more at his hand, completely well. Reaching the lobby, he gazed around him, at the people, the great chandelier overhead. Jory, in many respects, had done a good job, despite the reversion to these older forms. Real, he thought, experiencing the floor beneath his feet. I can't get over it. He thought, Jory must have had experience. He must have done this many times before. Going to the hotel desk, he said to the clerk, You have a restaurant that you'd recommend? Down the street, the clerk said, pausing in his task of sorting mail, to your right, the Matador. You'll find it excellent, sir. I'm lonely, Joe said on impulse. Does the hotel have any source of supply? Any girls? The clerk said in a clipped, disapproving voice, Not this hotel, sir. This hotel does not pander. You keep a good, clean family hotel, Joe said. We like to think so, sir. I was just testing you, Joe said. I wanted to be sure what kind of hotel I was staying in. He left the counter, recrossed the lobby, made his way down the wide marble stairs, through the revolving door, and onto the pavement outside. Chapter 16 Wake up to a hearty, lip-smacking bowl full of nutritious, nourishing, ubic toasted flakes. The adult cereal that's more crunchy, more tasty, more amish. Ubic breakfast cereal, the whole bowl tastes treat. Do not exceed recommended portion at any one meal. The diversity of cars impressed him. Many years represented, many makes and many models. The fact that they mostly came in black could not be laid at Jory's door. This detail was authentic. But how did Jory know it? That's peculiar, he thought. Jory's knowledge of the minutiae of 1939, a period in which none of us lived, except Glenn Runciter. Then all at once he realized why. Jory had told the truth. He had constructed not this world, but the world, or rather its phantasmagoric counterpart, of their own time. Decomposition back to these forms was not of his doing. They happened despite his efforts. These are natural atavisms, Joe realized, happening mechanically as Jory's strength wanes. As the boy says, it's an enormous effort. This is perhaps the first time he has created a world this diverse for so many people at once. It isn't usual for so many half-lifers to be interwired. We have put an abnormal strain on Jory, he said to himself, and we paid for it. A square old Dodge taxi sputtered past. Joe waved at it, and the cab floundered noisily to the curb. Let's test out what Jory said, he said to himself, as to the early boundary of this quasi-world now. To the driver, he said, Take me for a ride through town. Go anywhere you want. I'd like to see as many streets and buildings and people as possible, and then, when you've driven through all of Des Moines, I want you to drive me to the next town, and we'll see that. I don't go between towns, mister, the driver said, holding the door open for Joe, but I'll be glad to drive you around Des Moines. It's a nice city, sir. You're from out of state, aren't you? New York, Joe said, getting inside the cab. The cab rolled back out into traffic. How do they feel about the war back in New York? The driver asked presently. Do you think we'll be getting into it? Roosevelt wants to get us. I don't care to discuss politics or the war. Joe said harshly. They drove for a time in silence, watching the buildings, people, and cars go by. Joe asked himself again how Jory could maintain it all. So many details, he marveled. I should be coming to the edge of it soon. It has to be just about now. Driver, he said, are there any houses of prostitution here in Des Moines? No, the driver said. Maybe Jory can't manage that, Joe reflected, because of his youth, or maybe he disapproves. He felt all at once tired. Where am I going, he asked himself, and what for? To prove to myself that what Jory told me is true? I already know it's true. I saw the doctor wink out. I saw Jory emerge from inside Don Denny. That should have been enough. All I'm doing this way is putting more of a load on Jory, which will increase his appetite. I'd better give up, he decided. This is pointless. and as Jory had said, the Ubik would be wearing off anyhow. This driving around Des Moines is not the way I want to spend my last minutes or hours of life. There must be something else. Along the sidewalk, a girl moved in a slow, easy gait. She seemed to be window shopping. A pretty girl with gay, blonde pigtails, wearing an unbuttoned sweater over her blouse, a bright red skirt and high-heeled little shoes. "Slow the cab," he instructed the driver. "There, by that girl with the pigtails." "She won't talk to you," the driver said. "She'll call a cop." Joe said, "I don't care." It hardly mattered at this point. Slowing, the old Dodge bumbled its way to the curb. Its tires protested as they rubbed against the curb. The girl glanced up. "Hi, miss," Joe said. She regarded him with curiosity. Her warm, intelligent blue eyes widened a little, but they showed no aversion or alarm. Rather, she seemed slightly amused at him, but in a friendly way. "Yes," she said. "I'm going to die," Joe said. "Oh, dear," the girl said with concern. "Are you?" "He's not sick," the driver put in. "He's been asking after girls. He just wants to pick you up," the girl laughed, without hostility, and she did not depart. "It's almost dinner time," Joe said to her. "Let me take you to a restaurant, the Matador. I understand that's nice." His tiredness now had increased. He felt the weight of it on him, and then he realized with muted, weary horror that it consisted of the same fatigue which had attacked him in the hotel lobby after he had shown the police citation to Pat, and the cold, stealthily the physical experience of the cold pack surrounding him, had come back. "The Ubik is beginning to wear off," he realized. "I don't have much longer." Something must have showed in his face. The girl walked toward him, up to the window of the cab. "Are you all right?" she asked. Joe said with effort, "I'm dying, miss." The wound on his hand, the teeth marks had begun to throb once more, and were again becoming visible. This alone would have been enough to fill him with dread. "Have the driver take you to the hospital," the girl said. "Can we have dinner together?" Joe asked her. "Is that what you want to do?" she said. "When you're, whatever it is, sick? Are you sick?" She opened the door of the cab then. "Do you want me to go with you to the hospital? Is that it?" "To the Matador," Joe said. "We'll have braised fillet of Martian mole cricket." He remembered then that that imported delicacy did not exist in this time period. "Market steak," he said. "Beef. Do you like beef?" Getting into the cab, the girl said to the driver, "He wants to go to the Matador." "Okay, miss," the driver said. The cab rolled out into traffic once more. At the next intersection, the driver made a U-turn. "Now," Joe realized, "we are on our way to the restaurant. I wonder if I'll make it there." Fatigue and cold had invaded him completely. He felt his body processes begin to close down one by one. Organs that had no future. The liver did not need to make red blood cells. The kidneys did not need to excrete waste. The intestines no longer served any purpose. Only the heart, laboring on, and the increasingly difficult breathing. Each time he drew air into his lungs, he sensed the concrete block that had situated itself on his chest. "My gravestone," he decided. His hand, he saw, was bleeding again. Thick, slow blood appeared, drop by drop. "Care for a lucky strike?" the girl asked him, extending her pack toward him. "They are toasted," as the slogan goes. The phrase LSMFT won't come into existence until... Joe said, "My name is Joe Chip." "Do you want me to tell you my name?" "Yes," he grated and shut his eyes. He couldn't speak any further for a time, anyhow. "Do you like Des Moines?" he asked her presently, concealing his hand from her. "Have you lived here a long time?" "You sound very tired, Mr. Chip," the girl said. "Oh, hell," he said, gesturing. "It doesn't matter." "Yes, it does." The girl opened her purse, rummaged briskly within it. "I'm not a deformation of Jory's. I'm not like him," she indicated the driver, "or like these little old stores and houses and this dingy street, all these people and their Neolithic cars. Here, Mr. Chip." From her purse she brought an envelope, which she passed to him. "This is for you. Open it right away. I don't think either of us should have delayed so long." With leaden fingers he tore open the envelope. In it he found a certificate, stately and ornamented. The printing on it, however, swam. He was too weary now to read. "What's it say?" he asked her, laying it down on his lap. "From the company that manufactures Ubik," the girl said. "It is a guarantee, Mr. Chip, of a free lifetime supply. Free because I know your problem regarding money, your, shall we say, idiosyncrasy, and a list on the reverse of all the drugstores which carry it. Two drugstores and not abandoned ones in Des Moines are listed. I suggest we go to one first before we eat dinner. Here, driver." She leaned forward and handed the driver a slip of paper already written out. "Take us to this address. And hurry, they'll be closing soon." Joe lay back against the seat, panting for breath. "We'll make it to the drugstore," the girl said, and patted his arm reassuringly. "Who are you?" Joe asked her. "My name is Ella. Ella Hyde Runciter, your employer's wife." "You're here with us?" Joe said. "On this side? You're in Coldpack?" "As you well know, I have been for some time," Ella Runciter said. "Fairly soon I'll be reborn into another womb, I think. At least Glenn says so. I keep dreaming about a smoky red light, and that's bad. That's not a morally proper womb to be born into." She laughed a rich, warm laugh. "You're the other one," Joe said. "Jory destroying us, you trying to help us. Behind you there's no one, just as there's no one behind Jory. I've reached the last entities involved," Ella said caustically. "I don't think of myself as an entity. I usually think of myself as Ella Runciter." "But it's true," Joe said. "Yes," somberly she nodded. "Why are you working against Jory?" "Because Jory invaded me," Ella said. "He menaced me in the same way he's menaced you. We both know what he does. He told you himself in your hotel room. Sometimes he becomes very powerful. On occasion he manages to supplant me when I'm active and trying to talk to Glenn. But I seem to be able to cope with him better than most half-lifers, with or without Ubik. Better, for instance, than your group. Even acting as a collective." "Yes," Joe said. "It certainly was true. Well proved." "When I'm reborn," Ella said, "Glenn won't be able to consult with me anymore. I have a very selfish, practical reason for assisting you, Mr. Chip. I want you to replace me. I want to have someone whom Glenn can ask for advice and assistance, whom he can lean on. You will be ideal. You'll be doing in half-life what you did in full life. So, in a sense, I'm not motivated by noble sentiments. I save you from Jory for a good common-sense reason," she added. "And God knows I detest Jory." "After you're reborn," Joe said, "I won't succumb." "You have your lifetime supply of Ubik, as it says on the certificate I gave you," Joe said. "Maybe I can defeat Jory."
"Destroy him, you mean?"
Ella pondered. "He's not invulnerable. Maybe in time you can learn ways to nullify him. I think that's really the best you can hope to do. I doubt if you can truly destroy him, in other words, consume him, as he does to half-lifers placed near him at the moratorium."
"Hell," Joe said, "I'll tell Glenn Runciter of the situation and have him move Jory out of the moratorium entirely."
"Glenn has no authority to do that."
"Won't Schoenheit von Vogelsang," Ella said.
"Herbert is paid a great deal of money annually by Jory's family to keep him with the others and to think up plausible reasons for doing so. And there are Jorys in every moratorium. This battle goes on wherever you have half-lifers. It's a verity, a rule of our kind of existence." She lapsed into silence then. For the first time he saw on her face an expression of anger, a ruffled, taut look that disturbed her tranquility. "It has to be fought on our side of the glass," Ella said, "by those of us in half-life, those the jury preys on. You'll have to take charge, Mr. Chip, after I'm reborn. Do you think you can do that? It'll be hard. Jory will be sapping your strength always, putting a burden on you that you'll feel as," she hesitated, "the approach of death, which it will be, because in half-life we diminish constantly anyhow. Jory only speeds it up. The weariness and cooling off come anyhow, but not so soon. To himself, Joe thought, I can remember what he did to Wendy. That'll keep me going, that alone. Here's a drugstore, miss, the driver said. The square, upright old Dodge wheezed to the curb and parked. I won't go in with you, L.O. Runciter said to Joe as he opened the door and crept shakily out. Goodbye. Thanks for your loyalty to Glenn. Thanks for what you're going to be doing for him. She leaned toward him, kissed him on the cheek. Her lips seemed to him ripe with life, and some of it was conveyed to him. He felt slightly stronger. Good luck with Jory. She settled back, composed herself sedately, her purse on her lap. Joe shut the cab door, stood, then made his way haltingly into the drugstore. Behind him, the cab thub-thubbed off. He heard, but did not see it go. Within the solemn lamp-lit interior of the drugstore, a bald pharmacist wearing a formal dark vest, bow tie, and sharply pressed shark-skin trousers approached him. Afraid we're closing, sir. I was just coming to lock the door. But I'm in, Joe said, and I want to be waited on. He showed the pharmacist the certificate which Ella had given him. Squinting through his round, rimless glasses, the pharmacist labored over the Gothic printing. Are you going to wait on me? Joe asked. Ubik, the pharmacist said. I believe I'm out of that. Let me check and see. He started off. Jory, Joe said. Turning his head, the pharmacist said, Sir? You're Jory, Joe said. I can tell now, he said to himself. I'm learning to know him when I encounter him. You invented this drugstore, he said, and everything in it except for the spray cans of Ubik. You have no authority over Ubik. That comes from Ella. He forced himself into motion. Step by step, he edged his way behind the counter to the shelves of medical supplies. Peering in the gloom over one shelf after the other, he tried to locate the Ubik. The lighting of the store had dimmed. The antique fixtures were fading. I've regressed all the Ubik in this store, the pharmacist said, in a youthful, high-pitched, Jory voice. Back to the liver and kidney balm. It's no good now. I'll go to the other drugstore that has it, Joe said. He leaned against a counter, painfully drawing in slow, irregular gulps of air. Jory, from within the balding pharmacist, said, It'll be closed. Tomorrow, Joe said. I can hold out until tomorrow morning. You can't, Jory said. And anyhow, the Ubik at that drugstore will be regressed, too. Another town, Joe said. Wherever you go, it'll be regressed. Back to the salve, or back to the powder, or back to the elixir, or back to the balm. You'll never see a spray can of it, Joe Chip. Jory, in the form of the bald-headed pharmacist, smiled, showing celluloid-like dentures. I can... He broke off, gathering his meager vitality to him, trying by his own strength to warm his stiffening, cold-numbed body. Bring it up to the present, he said, to 1992. Can you, Mr. Chip? The pharmacist handed Joe a square pasteboard container. Here you are. Open it and you'll see, Joe said. I know what I'll see. He concentrated on the blue jar of liver and kidney balm. Evolve forward, he said to it, flooding it with his need. He poured whatever energy he had left onto the container. It did not change. This is the regular world, he said to it. Spray can, he said aloud. He shut his eyes, resting. It's not a spray can, Mr. Chip, the pharmacist said. Going here and there in the drugstore, he shut off lights. At the cash register, he punched a key and the drawer rattled open. Expertly, the pharmacist transferred the bills and change from the drawer into a metal box with a lock on it. You are a spray can, Joe said to the pasteboard container which he held in his hand. This is 1992, he said, and tried to exert everything. He put the entirety of himself into the effort. The last light blinked out, turned off by the pseudo-pharmacist. A dull gleam shone into the drugstore from the street lamp outside. By it, Joe could make out the shape of the object in his hand, its box-like lines. Opening the door, the pharmacist said, Come on, Mr. Chip, time to go home. She was wrong, wasn't she? And you won't see her again because she's so far on the road to being reborn. She
He's not thinking about you anymore, or me, or Runcider. What Ella sees now are various lights, red and dingy, then maybe bright orange. What I hold here, Joe said, is a spray can.
No, the pharmacist said. I'm sorry, Mr. Chip, I really am. But it's not. Joe set the pasteboard container down on a nearby counter. He turned with dignity and began a long, slow journey across the drugstore to the front door, which the pharmacist held open for him. Neither of them spoke until Joe at last passed through the doorway and out onto the nocturnal sidewalk. Behind him, the pharmacist emerged, too. He bent and locked the door after the two of them.
I think I'll complain to the manufacturer, Joe said. About the...
He ceased talking. Something constricted his throat. He could not breathe, and he could not speak. Then, temporarily, the blockage abated.
Your regressed drugstore,
he finished. Good night, the pharmacist said. He remained for a moment, eyeing Joe in the evening gloom. Then, shrugging, he started off. To his left, Joe made out the dark shape of a bench where people waited for a streetcar. He managed to reach it, to seat himself. The other persons, two or three, whichever it was, squeezed away from him, either out of aversion or to give him room, he could not tell which, and he didn't care. All he felt was the support of the bench beneath him, the release of some of his vast inertial weight. A few more minutes, he said to himself. If I remember right. Christ, what a thing to have to go through, he said to himself, for the second time. Anyhow, we tried, he thought. As he watched the yellow flickering lights and neon signs, the flow of cars going in both directions directly before his eyes, he thought to himself, Runcider kicked and struggled. Ella has been scratching and biting and gouging for a long time. And, he thought, I damn near evolved the jar of ubic liver and kidney balm back to the present. I almost succeeded. There was something in knowing that, an awareness of his own great strength, his final transcendental attempt. The streetcar, a clanging metal enormity, came to a grating halt before the bench. The several people beside Joe rose and hurried out to board it by its rear platform.
Hey, mister, the conductor yelled to Joe. Are you coming or aren't you?
Joe said nothing. The conductor waited, then jerked his signal cord. Noisily, the streetcar started up. It continued on, and then at last disappeared beyond his range of vision. Lots of luck, Joe said to himself as he heard the racket of the streetcar's wheels die away. And so long. He leaned back, closed his eyes.
Excuse me.
Bending over him in the darkness, a girl in a synthetic ostrich leather coat. He looked up at her, jarred into awareness.
Mr. Chip, she said.
Pretty and slender, dressed in hat, gloves, suit, and high heels. She held something in her hand. He saw the outline of a package.
Of New York? Of Runcider Associates? I don't want to give this to the wrong person.
I'm Joe Chip, he said.
For a moment he thought the girl might be Ella Runcider, but he had never seen her before.
Who sent you?
He said. Dr. Sunderbar, the girl said. The younger Dr. Sunderbar, son of Dr. Sunderbar, the founder.
Who's that?
The name meant nothing to him. And then he remembered where he had seen it.
The liver and kidney man, he said. Processed oleander leaves, oil of peppermint, charcoal, cobalt chloride, zinc oxide.
Weariness overcame him. He stopped talking. The girl said, by making use of the most advanced techniques of modern-day science, the reversion of matter to earlier forms can be reversed, and at a price any Conapt owner can afford. Ubik is sold by leading home art stores throughout Earth. So look for it at the place you shop, Mr. Chip. Fully conscious now, he said,
look for it where?
He struggled to his feet, stood inexpertly swaying.
You're from 1992. What you said came from Runcider's TV commercial.
An evening wind rustled at him, and he felt it tug at him, drawing him away with it. He seemed to be like some ragged bundle of webs and cloth, barely holding together.
Yes, Mr. Chip, the girl handed him a package. You brought me from the future by what you did there inside the drugstore a few moments ago.
You summoned me directly from the factory. Mr. Chip, I could spray it on you if you're too weak to. Shall I? I'm an official factory representative and technical consultant. I know how to apply it. She took the package swiftly back from his trembling hands. Tearing it open, she immediately sprayed him with Ubik. In the dusk, he saw the spray can glint. He saw the happy colored lettering. Thanks, he said after a time. After he felt better. And warmer. The girl said, You didn't need as much this time as you did in the hotel room. You must be stronger than before. Here, take the can of it. You might need it before morning. Can I get more? Joe said. When this runs out? Evidently so. If you got me here once, I would assume you can get me here again the same way. She moved away from him, merging with the shadows created by the dense walls of closed-up nearby stores. What is Ubik? Joe said, wanting her to stay. A spray can of Ubik, the girl answered, is a portable negative ionizer with a self-contained high-voltage, low-amp unit powered by a peak-gain helium battery of 25 kilovolts. The negative ions are given a counterclockwise spin by a radically biased acceleration chamber, which creates a centripetal tendency to them so that they cohere rather than dissipate. A negative ion field diminishes the velocity of anti-protophasons normally present in the atmosphere. As soon as their velocity falls, they cease to be anti-protophasons, and, under the principle of parity, no longer can unite with protophasons radiated from persons frozen in cold pack, that is, those in half-life. The end result is that the proportion of protophasons not canceled by anti-protophasons increases, which means, for a specific time anyhow, an increment in the net put-forth field of protophasonic activity, which the affected half-lifer experiences as greater vitality plus a lowering of the experience of low cold-pack temperatures. So you can see why regressed forms of Ubik fail to, Joe said reflexively, to say negative ions is redundant. All ions are negative. Again the girl moved away. Maybe I'll see you again, she said gently. It was rewarding to bring you the spray can. Maybe next time, maybe we can have dinner together, Joe said. I'll look forward to it. She ebbed farther and farther away. Who invented Ubik? Joe asked. A number of responsible half-lifers whom Jory threatened, but principally by Ella Runciter. It took her and them working together a long, long time, and there still isn't very much of it available as yet. Ebbing from him in her trim, covert way, she continued to retreat, and then, by degrees, was gone. At the Matador, Joe called after her. I understand Jory did a good job materializing it, or regressing it just right, whatever it is he does. He listened, but the girl did not answer. Carefully carrying the spray can of Ubik, Joe Chip walked out to greet the evening traffic, searching for a cab. Under a streetlight, he held up the spray can of Ubik, read the printing on the label. I think her name is Myra Laney. Look on reverse side of container for address and phone number. Thanks, Joe said to the spray can. We are served by organic ghosts, he thought, who, speaking and writing, pass through this, our new environment. Watching, wise, physical ghosts from the full life world, elements of which have become for us invading but agreeable splinters of a substance that pulsates like a former heart. And all of them, he thought, thanks to Glenn Runciter. In particular, the writer of instructions, labels, and notes, valuable notes. He raised his arm to slow to a grumpy halt a passing 1936 Graham cab. Chapter 17. I am Ubik. Before the universe was, I am. I made the suns. I made the worlds. I created the lives and the places they inhabit. I moved them here. I put them there. They go as I say. They do as I tell them. I am the word, and my name is never spoken, the name which no one knows. I am called Ubik, but that is not my name. I am. I shall always be. Glenn Runciter could not find a moratorium owner. Are you sure you don't know where he is, Runciter? Asked Miss Beeson, the moratorium owner's secretary. It's essential that I talk to Ella again. I'll have her brought out, Miss Beeson said. You may use Office 4B. Please wait there, Mr. Runciter. I will have your wife for you in a very short time. Try to make yourself comfortable. Locating Office 4B, Runciter paced about restlessly. At last, a moratorium attendant appeared, wheeling in Ella's casket on a hand truck. Sorry to keep you waiting, the attendant said. He began at once to set up the electronic communing mechanism, humming happily as he worked. In short order, the task was completed. The attendant checked the circuit one last time, nodded in satisfaction, then started to leave the office. This is for you, Runciter said, and handed him several 50-cent pieces, which he had scrounged from his various pockets. I appreciate the rapidity with which you accomplished the job. Thank you, Mr. Runciter, the attendant said. He glanced at the coins, then frowned. What kind of money is this, he said. Runciter took a good long look at the 50-cent pieces. He saw at once what the attendant meant. Very definitely the coins were not as they should be. Whose profile is this, he asked himself. Who's this on all three coins? Not the right person at all, and yet he's familiar. I know him. And then he recognized the profile. I wonder what this means, he asked himself. Strangest thing I've ever seen. Most things in life eventually can be explained, but Joe Chip on a 50-cent piece? It was the first Joe Chip money he had ever seen. He had an intuition, chillingly, that if he searched his pockets and his billfold, he would find more. This was just the beginning. End of Ubik by Philip K. Dick. Narrated by Jeff Halberstadt in the studios of North Texas Taping and Radio for the Blind, for the Library of Congress, February 1993. For special distribution is authorized by Act of Congress under Public Law 89-522, with the permission of the copyright holder and the publisher, Vintage Books, a division of Random House, Incorporated, New York. If you found any cassette in this book to be defective, please place a rubber band or piece of string around that cassette for identification. Place it in a container on top of the front stack of cassettes.